Nice Questions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 20th episode of Robots. In the first part of this two-part special on robot ethics that aired 2 weeks ago, we spoke with Noel Sharkey from the University of Sheffield on issues dealing with military robots, robots in the society, medical robots, and legal responsibilities. In the second part presented today, we will speak with Ronald Arkin from Georgia Tech about the exact same issues as seen from a very different point of view.
Both guests are renowned experts in ethics in robotics, having authored many articles on the subject and being interviewed by international media. But first, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. The Israel Aerospace Industries, or IAI, has unveiled its newest lethal UAV, the Harop, or Harpy 2. The Harop is a medium-sized kamikaze-type UAV intended to circle the sky for up to 6 hours before crashing into its target and detonating a 23-kilogram warhead. Unlike its fully autonomous predecessor, the Harop is controlled in flight by a remote operator. In a typical configuration, the drone is launched from a canister battery transported by ship or truck, with a 3-truck battery capable of deploying up to 54 drones for simultaneous coordinated attack. Among other countries, Turkey and India have both announced their interest in the new UAV. Researchers at the University of California, San Diego have demonstrated a balancing and climbing robot. The iLean has a Segway-like basic structure consisting of two large wheels and a pole. On encountering an obstacle, such as a large rock or the step of a staircase, the robot's main body can lean its pole against the obstacle and then climb up the pole till it tumbles over the rock or onto the next step. Next to the iLean robot, the same group has also released a jumping version called the iHop. Carnegie Mellon and other Pittsburgh area universities and community colleges have joined forces with more than 24 industry partners to create a new associate degree program in robotics. The 2-year program is intended to educate future mid-level managers and highly qualified technologists in robotics and other embedded computer system industries. Courses are set to begin this fall at the California University of Pennsylvania, Westmoreland County Community College, and Butler County Community College. For more information and discussion on this week's news, including a video of the Israel's new Harop UAV, videos of the iLean and the iHop robots, and more information on CMU's new degree program, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Our second guest in this ethics special, Ronald Arkin, is director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory and dean of research at Georgia Tech in the U.S. His research has led to several textbooks such as Behavior-Based Robotics and Robot Colonies, and his lab specializes in both ground-based, air-based, and swarming autonomous robots. His upcoming book, Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots, looks at the ethics of military robots.
Hi, Ron. Welcome to Robots.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sabine.
Maybe start by telling us why ethics is an issue in robotics.
Ethics is an issue in robotics for the same reason that ethics is an issue in any form of technology. Whenever we introduce new artifacts into society, it produces a change in that society. That change may be for the better, or it may not be. And it's crucially important that we understand the ramifications of technological artifacts, including robots, on society as a whole. It's not clear what particular impact robotics will have. in the future in terms of manufacturing, in terms of military applications, in terms of personal robotics, medical robotics, a whole range of different issues. And scientists generally tend to be somewhat ignorant of the ethical aspects of their work, including myself for years as well. We get lost in the joy of discovery. And while we're creating things, we don't fully understand exactly what's going to happen with them when they move out of the laboratory into the real world. It's important for our scientists to understand that, and it's important for those people who are potentially going to be importing robots and other technology into their lives to understand what might happen as a consequence of that.
I have a feeling that robotics raises more ethical issues than, for example, another machine or your dishwasher. Why is that?
Well, a dishwasher in its day probably raised ethical issues as well, but we're well acclimated to that societally. Part of the reason, I guess, is the notion of situatedness and embedding that a robot provides. Robots are physical incarnations that can actually move out from under the kitchen counter, like your dishwasher, and can interact with people, perhaps even in human-like ways when we start to give them personalities and emotions and other characteristics that can increase our ability to relate to them. For those reasons, I think it is a different class of ethical concerns, but it's not completely different. I mean, some of the issues are still the same, and what's more important is understanding what ethics is and how it can be applied in this particular context.
So before, you said you've only been looking at ethics in the recent years, basically. When did scientists start looking into the ethics of robotics?
Science fiction people have been looking at that for some time. Of course, the great Isaac Asimov with his three laws of robotics, which actually are four laws of robotics, the zeroth law was created later, served as an inspiration for many people to consider the ramifications of what this technology may do in terms of societal impact. But that was science fiction. And for many of us, while we we have to give credit to Asimov for his imagination and his ability to lead in the field of robot ethics, if you will, the laws that he postulated, many of us feel, were inadequate for real-world types of scenarios. So that was probably the start of it. As you know, perhaps from previous talks and the like, the word robot actually dates back to slave or worker from a play by Carol Capek in Rossum's Universal Robots, where robots eventually destroyed all of mankind, which is a theme in Western civilization for robots and the like. Asimov at least tempered that view by trying to understand that robots could work for both good and bad, but they could introduce different types of ethical dilemmas. Roboticists, or scientists who study robots, have been focusing on robot ethics, I would say, since around 2004. The first symposium on roboethics was held in San Remo, Italy, which I had the good fortune to participate in. And we discussed with members of the Vatican, with the Geneva Convention, with the Pugwash Institute, which involved the Russell Einstein Manifesto related to proliferation of nuclear weapons, and many roboticists, some of the consequences of our work. And that was really energizing and important experience for me to be able to understand what it is that we're doing. And it made me kind of an activist in the field.
So basically, you gathered in 2004. What has been done since then, concretely?
A lot of different things. Again, folks such as myself have been able to attain funding from government agencies to study the problem. We have had biannual conferences, or actually workshops, at ICRA, which is the International Conference in Robotics and Automation, sponsored by the IEEE, or the IROS Conference, the International Robots and Systems Conference, on roboethics to continue the discussion. There is one coming up this May, for a matter of fact, which will be held in Kobe, Japan. Others in Europe, for example, have developed a roadmap for roboethics under European funding to be able to understand the broad range of issues that robots bring to the table. And in Korea, in South Korea, there was a robo-ethics charter that was created for that nation as well, too. All getting people involved in the discussion of what is the appropriate use of this technology and what we as scientists should possibly be studying and what we as a society could conceivably use in this context from robotics.
Let's look at one of the main subjects which has been in the media recently. That's military robots. Governments across the world have been pumping billions into the development of military robots. What ethical questions does this raise?
Oh, there's many. And perhaps, as you know, I have a book coming out in May of this year entitled Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots, addressing many of the issues associated with the use of military robots. There's many different aspects. Some of the robots are used just for surveillance, but more and more, as we've seen with the Predator unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, and the Reaper UAVs as well, too, these are now being used to engage targets in Afghanistan and Iraq, even over the border into Pakistan in some circumstances. These have human operators in the loop, and that means that the human is in charge of the weapons release of that particular system. But for ground platforms, as they become armed and other unmanned systems, due to the tempo of warfare, more and more of the decision-making will be pushed forward onto the robot. And it is my belief and several others that, like it or not, these robots are ultimately going to be making life or death decisions regarding weapons use in the battlefield.
Do you think that this is a good development for robotics?
Many people don't. And pacifists, of course, would argue that any form of technology that's being developed for warfare is a bad thing. So it depends a lot on your stance. It depends also how you do it. One of the concerns that I have is if this is going to happen, it has to be done ethically. And my recent work for the Army Research Organization and outlined in many papers on my website and in the book refers to how we can embed an ethical sense, or what I like to refer to as an artificial conscience, into these machines so that they will follow the laws of war and the rules of engagement, perhaps even better than human soldiers do.
So maybe they can make better decisions in life-death situations.
That's exactly correct. The intent, interestingly, is actually not necessarily with this work to increase mission performance. It's not to erode mission performance, but actually to provide better safety and security for non-combatants and other collateral civilian property that might be destroyed otherwise. Robots don't have to defend themselves in the same way that human beings do, so they can act far more conservatively than a human soldier might. Soldiers are technically supposed to take risk on behalf of civilians, but it's very, very hard to do that. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do when you're staring down a barrel of a gun. There are many issues associated with robotic systems which change the equation in ways which can actually help civilians and preserve civilian lives if deployed properly. But that's not to say it's not without inherent danger.
You spoke of giving them a sense of ethics. Are we talking here about something like emotion or empathy, or is this really laws which they should follow?
Well, there's actually four different components for the architecture that I've outlined for the design of these systems. One is what I call the ethical governor, and it's called a governor after, in the same sense that James Watt called a steam engine governor, to bring a machine into proper limits so it can perform effectively. He did it by controlling the RPM of the steam engine so it wouldn't blow up. This ethical governor is to ensure that the performance of a robotic engine, so to speak, which consists of a software architecture, is constrained by the laws of war and the rules of engagement. So we don't use rules per se. We use something called constraints as the means for ensuring that a proper behavior is resolved. That's one aspect. Another aspect is ensuring that the design of the behaviors in the architecture, in the robot itself, are ethically correct in the first place. That's hard to do, and we're just beginning to consider some of the issues associated with that. The third one does deal with emotions. Some emotions in the battlefield are not good at all, as you might imagine. Anger, fear, those sorts of things cloud judgment and in humans. And we can ensure that robots don't possess those kind of emotions in the battlefield. But there are emotions which could be useful. One of the ones that we are looking at is guilt, for example. So that if a robot recognizes that it has done something incorrectly while in the field, it can, either through its own actions and its own evaluation or through supervisory commands, it can basically not fire any longer. It can restrain its weapon systems, but still allow it to remain on the field and act as an observer in that case. It doesn't necessarily have to leave the field. There's also after-action review, where the robot with a human supervisor can potentially review everything that has transpired. And the final component of the overall architecture is something referred to as the responsibility advisor. One of the difficult questions, which is for human war crimes, let alone things that go wrong with robots, is how do we attribute responsibility when something goes wrong? It is one of the goals of the design of the system that we're building to ensure that responsibility is transparent and clear for all parties as they move through the system and deploy the system. And this includes designers, it includes the lawyers who design the rules of engagement and the constraints that are derived from those, as well as commanders, and in addition to that, ultimately the end users or soldiers that will deploy these systems.
Working with robots, I know that so many things can go wrong. Do you think it'll take a long time for people to actually trust the fact that a robot can make a good decision systematically?
That's a good question, and there's different applications for this. Historically, there has always been some reluctance at the beginning of when technology is introduced. But for example, right now, I don't know if it's, well, millions of people a year jump on the train at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. Nobody's driving that train, right? And we all trust it to not go off the track and not crash into something. And same thing with elevators. This dates me, but I remember the days where there were actually elevator personnel running the elevators. And now everyone pushes a button, and we have absolute faith that we will get there safely without fear. Engineering robustness and reliability into these systems is a daunting challenge, especially for robots that will be working among humans. But do I believe it can be accomplished in the years ahead? Yes, I do.
And maybe as a final conclusion for this subject, how do you see the future of war with robots in the picture? Will it be cheaper? Will it be? Will there be less wars?
It's hard to predict. I can talk more about how I envision the way robots will be used in the battlefield. Some people see Terminator-like visions where swarms of robots will be coming over the hills and engulfing the enemy. That's not how I envision the military using these systems. They will be used as what are called organic assets. They will be alongside human troops, and they will allow for a reduction in the number of people in the battlefield, but not for an elimination. Just as we used to have mules and dogs and other kinds of resources complementing the troops, I expect robots will play a similar role. And I believe the military, who is, as you mentioned earlier, heavily investing into this technology, believes that they will make war more efficient, effective, and ideally, hopefully, with the kinds of things that I'm talking about, more humane as well.
Is there something we shouldn't do in terms of military robots?
Well, as I've often said, if one thing we should do is have international discussions on this subject to determine whether or not we truly want to have autonomous systems in the battlefield in the first place. This is not a given. And there are bodies, the Hague and the Geneva Conventions, which can consider the appropriate use of this technology. if it is introduced in an unfettered way, I would be very concerned about the potential consequences of this work. So it's something that needs to be discussed thoroughly. Systems can go wrong. I do believe that our autonomous robots in the battlefield will not be perfectly ethical, but it is my base contention for the research that I do that they will be more ethical than human soldiers are in the battlefield today. That's my baseline. And it's important to recognize that I have tremendous respect for our warfighters who are out there even now conducting battles and fighting on behalf of our nation. But the problem is these are human beings, and these are human beings put into situations unlike any that have ever existed in history, with the tempo of warfare and the nature of weapons, and they are not evolved or designed, if you will, to function under these circumstances. And as a consequence, infractions, violations of war crimes are unfortunately more common than most people would like to think. There was a very good Surgeon General report who debriefed the returning troops from Operation Iraqi Freedom, and it was very disturbing to see the levels of potential war crimes that these people were ready to tolerate. I'm not surprised by it, but the bar is not quite as high as many people would think in terms of the way humans fight in the battlefield.
The next area I would like to address is the one of medical robots. We've seen a lot of medical robots have been foreseen or already used to, for example, navigate in the body or to replace or enhance human body parts. Again, what ethical questions do medical robots raise?
Right. Medical robots are not specifically the area that I work in, but I am concerned about those issues, and I have heard many people talk about those issues. One of the biggest ones I think that's involved is the potential disparity that can be created through the use of robotic prosthetic technology, where we start to enhance people to be able to do things in different ways that people couldn't do before. You might be stronger. You could become Iron Man, for example, or you could be faster. There was an interesting controversy recently about a potential Olympic contender who had an artificial leg and whether that gave him an unfair advantage in terms of racing because it actually had greater energy conservation in the leg than a human could possibly have. So the real question is, are we going to create multiple classes of human beings, those who have robotic enhancements and those who don't, or cyborgs, if you will? And if there are going to be robotic enhancements that we choose to allow, who gets them? Are they free for everybody, or is it only the rich that can get them? Just imagine, for example, plastic surgery taken to the nth degree, where suddenly we're now introducing all kinds of electronic technology, replacing body parts to create a ultimately better you. What are the consequences of that on society and on individuals? Should there be any restrictions or constraints on the way in which we do this? Those are all open questions right now.
Has there been any discussion on where the limit is between being a human or a machine?
Hans Moravec actually broached that issue, and I believe Rod Brooks as well, too, at MIT. Hans is at Carnegie Mellon. Hans used to talk about a transmigration experiment where imagine that your brain is replaced cell by cell with electronic circuitry. The question is, where do you stop becoming human? And a whole bunch of interesting issues. I would recommend anyone interested in that particular topic to take a look at Hans Moravec's books.
Robots will soon be a ubiquitous part of our society, assuming roles which usually humans assume nowadays. What ethical questions do you see in, for example, robots taking care of young people or old people or sick people?
That's a very good question. It's actually one I'm working on a proposal right now, especially for the elder care issues. There are several issues. Suppose, for example, you're growing older and you want to get a robot for your aging parents or grandparents you may turn them over to this machine, and even if it works perfectly, even if it provides the necessary bonding and so-called emotional support, is that really a good thing to do? And are you abrogating your responsibilities as a child or a dependent on this individual to provide the necessary emotional support and connection with reality? A lot of people have written for personal robots that it produces a suspension of disbelief. And I have worked in the past with Sony Corporation on Aibo and their Curio robot, the humanoid. And we've recognized that it is not hard at all to be able to form attachments with these machines. It's a natural propensity of human beings to be able to do that. And robot designers, by introducing emotions and certain aspects into these systems, can take advantage of that to form bonding. So we can create the illusion, that these machines are alive in some sense, even knowing consciously full well that they are just machines. But a deeper ethical question is, suppose we start introducing these robots into elder care homes. One of the things that we want to do is protect the rights of these individuals as well, too. Protect their human dignity as we introduce machines into their environments. That includes simple things such as privacy. It includes other things in terms of how do you react to an elderly person when it walks by? Do you get out of the way, or do you just keep on going and expect them to get out of the way? It might be viewed as courtesy, but once you start dealing with what we'll call challenged populations, it actually is more than just courtesy. It becomes ethics, because we want to ensure that people around robots never become less than human. And robots should help enhance the human condition as opposed to take away from it.
Dealing with people who have challenges is something that you don't really learn in the textbooks or at school. Do you think this is something where the robots will really have to be adaptive, be able to learn how to interact with certain people, etc.?
Good question. Again, there are colleagues of mine who work in the machine ethics community, not so much the robot ethics community, that I have spoken to and continue to speak to, which are very much concerned with how a robot can learn an ethical sense after being immersed in its environment. This is not an easy thing to do. There's another way that they can also learn through interaction with expert ethicists and listen, if you will, or have programming introduced through them through the use of cases and case-based reasoning, for example, as a basis to get them to behave more ethically. One way or the other, it's important, I believe, that as a design criteria for future robots, as they become more and more competent and become more and more ubiquitous, as you say, that some significant consideration of ethical behavior be involved, especially in the aspects of human-robot interaction, which are crucial for ultimate acceptance and effect on society.
So before you spoke of people who are able to attach to their caregivers, robotic caregivers, but generally we're talking about robotic pets, robotic friends, robotic colleagues. How do you see the future with respect to having such a personal relationship with robots?
That's a good question. I think you had, I was just looking at your webpage for your podcast, I saw you had a discussion with David Levy recently, and I had the pleasure not long ago of giving a keynote, I guess it was about this time last year, at the first conference on personal human-robot interaction, dealing with the issues of intimacy and where that will ultimately lead. Those are very significant ethical questions that we have to concern ourselves with. What is the appropriate boundary or limits for human-robot action and interaction? Should it be they are allowed to touch us and manipulate us in different ways? Should we encourage human beings to attach or even love a metallic or non-metallic artifact in some sense? These are questions that I am not going to answer for you because then I would be being prescriptive. What we need to do as a community of roboticists and sociologists and ethicists is discuss these questions intelligently and dispassionately and try and come up with guidelines so that we can determine what is best for the future of robotics. This is where roboethics is relatively young, because most people were not considering this at all. And now, finally, we are getting a slowly but surely broader-based discussion on these individual topics, including philosophers, including social scientists, including religious folks, and as well as roboticists and other technicians, all to the table and trying to get a better understanding of what are the consequences of what it is that we are creating. And I feel that is crucially important, not only for the personal or intimate robotics, if you will, but for many other applications as well.
Something I'm asked a lot as a consequence of robotics is, will these robots be taking our jobs? Should we be happy about them taking our jobs or not?
A good question. Again, that deals with the original definition of what robots were supposed to be used for. It was called the three Ds: dirty, dangerous, and dull. Although I do watch on the Discovery Channel Dirty Jobs by Mike Rowe, which is an interesting celebration of dirty jobs by human beings and how they actually can be rewarding in certain ways. But by and large, jobs that are dangerous, jobs that are boring or dull, jobs that are dirty, are places where human beings might be better suited to do other things. And robots should be targeted, I would contend, to try and encourage people to move to jobs that don't fit those particular categories, unless there's good reason to. Right now, losing jobs doesn't depend on robot technology, as you can see by the economy. It's not what robots are doing that's causing people to lose jobs. But we have survived and prospered through other forms of industrial revolutions in the past, both the traditional mechanical and manufacturing ones, and more recently computer revolutions. The robot revolution will again produce changes in our society, but with proper social treatment and handling of individuals who may be displaced, I think we will weather those changes well also.
We raised a lot of questions: robots in the society, medical robots, military robots. And I read a quote attributed to an American science fiction author, Bruce Sterling, which goes, "I don't think we need to make our robots ethical. What we need to do is make the people who make the robots ethical." So I'm wondering, what do we need to do in terms of limits that we need to set?
That's a good quote. Bruce actually was at that first international symposium on roboethics as well, too. And it was interesting hearing a science fiction person arguing against autonomous robots and non-ethical robots and the like as well, too. So he came from an unusual perspective. And I agree with him, absolutely. We do need to encourage the people who make the robots ethical. I don't know how you make anyone be ethical, but we have to raise the ethical awareness in those folks. But that doesn't mean that robots, even if created with an ethical sense by certain people, can't be misused, just as any technology, whether it's conventional weapon systems or almost anything, can be used for ill as well as good. So I think we need to do both in that regard. Following up, what was the last part of that? Setting limits? Do we need to set limits? Absolutely. We need to have discussions on this. We need to have discussions how to ensure that we educate those in engineering and computer science and science in general to follow ethical practices. There are portions of undergraduate curriculum right now for ABET accredited schools, such as ours, that require that you take an ethics course. Whether that sticks or not is another story, but at least an effort is being made to do that. We need to have discussions through international bodies to analyze both medical applications, military applications, all sorts of applications of this technology, and to determine as a society, and ideally as an international society, what the appropriate limits are for the use of this technology. And as you mentioned as well, too, funding agencies themselves can have a role by requiring that ethical aspects be evaluated. In the United States, for example, if we have human subjects associated with the research that we do, we have to go through rigorous IRBs or internal review board, excuse me, institute review boards to certify the studies to make sure that they protect the rights of the subjects that we're doing and to ensure that the research is conducted ethically. It's a non-trivial process to be able to do that. But that's just the beginnings of what needs to be done. So there are some things already in place, but much, much more is awaiting this field.
So efforts need to be done at many levels here.
Absolutely. And it would be naive to say that just one particular body or one particular group of people can come up with the answers for this. This is a societal issue and an intergovernmental issue as well. And all I can do is try and encourage people right now to take it seriously and to understand the potential consequences of this work and just to get the discussions going. And if we do that enough through podcasts such as what you're doing, hopefully voices will be heard and people will reach out and encourage actual formations of political bodies or societal bodies or whatever to create guidelines and then perhaps ultimately legal restrictions on what these systems can be used for.
With so many people involved, you have an idea on who in the end would be capable of taking the responsibility for a robot. Could it even be the robot itself?
Interesting question again as well, too. That's, some of it deals with philosophy. I at any time in the near future, refuse to attribute responsibility to the robot itself at this point in time. But many of my philosopher colleagues do argue that they can be moral agents even now. That's not my take on the situation. But you're right, there are many different people involved. There are the end users who deploy the robots. There are the designers who create the robots. There are the companies who manufacture the robots. There are the politicians who create the framework which determines acceptability for certain types of systems. Responsibility is distributed far and wide through our society for the potential ramifications of the use of this technology. And no one, in my estimation, is really immune, except perhaps the robot itself. Saying the robot is responsible for its actions right now, to me, is a cop-out, and saying we can't say that a human being can be held responsible for those actions. And to me, that's just hiding behind the robot.
Thanks, Ron, for being here with us on Robots.
My pleasure.
And this concludes our two-part special on robot ethics. We hope that this has given you some food for thought and a desire to get better informed on the various ethical issues that will come with the advancement of robotics.
For more information on our guests, or to give us your opinion on the ethics of robotics, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Raise Questions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.